I'm very happy now to welcome Gregory Heldman. He's the founder and director of the Santa Fe Symphony, and David Krakauer, who is professor and chair of the faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Now, the Santa Fe Symphony and the Santa Fe Institute are collaborating on a concert called Voyages of Discovery, Darwin and Mendelssohn. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here.
So Darwin and Mendelssohn, a scientist and a composer born almost exactly the same month of the same year. How did you think about putting these two guys together?
Well, the idea of the Santa Fe Symphony and Santa Fe Institute collaborating goes back 7 years when we were looking at our 20th anniversaries, because we share the same anniversaries between the two organizations. And we even talked about presenting a suite by John Adams. He had recently premiered Dr. Atomic at the San Francisco Opera, and we were hoping here in Santa Fe as part of these celebrations of our two organizations' anniversaries to blend science and music by having this suite by John Adams. And that didn't work out at the time. And since that period, Penelope Pinland, who's on our board of the Santa Fe Symphony, has been working with David and the Santa Fe Institute, exploring different ways that we can go across disciplines and illuminate these great icons of Western art and science.
David Krakauer, the parallels between the lives of Darwin and Mendelssohn are kind of striking.
Yeah, so they were born the same year, 1809, same year as Abe Lincoln and Alfred Tennyson and Edgar Allan Poe. And, of course, they were both born into very illustrious families. Felix Mendelssohn's grandfather, Moses Mendelssohn, was one of the great philosophers in Germany, great religious philosopher, and Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus, was one of the first evolutionary thinkers. And through a key figure that we don't mention in our program, Alexander von Humboldt, who attended the lectures of Moses and read the works of Erasmus, he instilled in that period a sense of voyaging and discovery, a sort of romantic trope of the lone intellectual taking risks and coming to an understanding of the world that was a big inspiration on both Darwin and Mendelssohn.
So the two of them both took voyages at certain times in their lives, and out of that came some of their greatest life's work.
That's correct. For Mendelssohn, his father sent him on a European sojourn, and Mendelssohn had a very close family life. But on this European sojourn, from the sojourn, probably the best known piece is the Hebrides Overture, because he went to Scotland and he went to the Hebrides Island, and in fact he was so taken by the sea trip and this ocean crossing that he wrote to his sister the exact manuscript that ended up being the thematic material for the overture as it became known later. Also during that period he wrote the Scottish Symphony, the Italian Symphony, which you'll be able to play.
We're going to hear a little bit of it later.
And so the most famous sojourn, if you will, for Darwin, of course, was to the Galapagos in South America. And so this is very interesting, although they were probably several decades apart when they did these different trips. But the fact that they, for Mendelssohn, from a musical standpoint, he was going from the classical period of Beethoven into the romantic period that we best know of Wagner and Richard Strauss. He's very much a transitional figure, very much looking ahead. The Hebrides is panoramic, is picturesque, the Italian. Again, this idea of programmatic music. And so he was developing a new way to categorize, if you will, the musical nomenclature, the new musical styles of the time, to elicit certain emotions and certain images in the listener's mind.
Meanwhile, Darwin's voyage of discovery was another way of getting him out of his English world, and that opened him up in ways that are still very much important to us.
Yeah, sure. I mean, they weren't that far apart. So Darwin left, of course, in 1831, and Mendelssohn was in the late 1820s traveling to Scotland. Of course, Darwin was traveling further afield. He was really following in the footsteps of Humboldt. But I think the differences are with Darwin and Mendelssohn is when the events that they experienced on their travels really made it into their work. I mean, for Mendelssohn, who was this prodigy, everything he saw was instantaneously transmuted into art. But that's not true for Darwin. I mean, Darwin didn't publish really in full form the things that he observed and came to understand until he was 50. And Mendelssohn was doing this in his 20s.
Well, he was writing important pieces when he was in before his teenage years.
Absolutely. Mendelssohn was a prodigy, as David said, and it's sad that he was one of those prodigies who died too soon. I think it was at the age of 38. Stephen Smith, our music director, in his research might raises the question, did Mendelssohn die of a broken heart because of deaths in his family? It was very difficult when he lost his sister. And, or, you know, we're not sure exactly what was the cause of his Mendelssohn's demise, but one can only wonder what his artistic output would have been if he had lived as long as Darwin.
Mm-hmm. Then that's so true of so many composers who died in their 30s. It's uncanny, from Mozart to Schubert. And,
right.
Yeah. I think it's also important to talk about the fact that during the time of Mendelssohn and Darwin, art and science, music and science, were not necessarily as separated as they are today.
We were having that discussion last week, as a matter of fact.
No, that's right. I mean, I think that it would be just a bit of a... We discussed this. It would be a little bit of a gimmick if we were just relying on the coincidence of chronology. I mean, 1809 is an interesting year, but it's really the cultural moment that the... There are many things that make them similar. I mean, they were both... I mean, the event will demonstrate this. Both huge letter writers. Darwin wrote, we have on file, just under 15,000 letters from Darwin. And we have about 5,000 letters from Felix. They were using their letters during their trips to come to a better understanding of their work. They were corresponding with an incredibly wide range of people, scientists, musicians. Darwin's letters are full of references to music. In 1835, just before they came back, when he was in the Andes on an inland expedition, he wrote to his sister that he was ravenous for the piano. And so, yeah, this was the Romantic period. I mean, Darwin and Mendelssohn were born in the period that has Goethe and Schelling and Byron and Keats. So it was a special culture, and these people, and of course Tennyson was born in 1809. In fact, last month in Cambridge in England, there was a conference on Darwin and Tennyson. And these are poets who wrote about science. And art was important to Darwin. It became increasingly less important in his life. And when his friends wrote to him from London, from a musical event, he would say that he'd completely dried up, that talking about celestial music was like offering cold water to a desert dweller. He used music as a means of illustrating his increasing scientific disposition, his move towards a more analytical frame of mind. In his youth, he was far more moved.
Well, it's interesting to think about when... I mean, I don't know what the culture is like at the Santa Fe Institute, but a lot of... it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, contemporary scientific cultures, people working together, are really not integrating the depth of artistic musical thinking into their daily lives or being influenced in their work.
It's tricky. I mean, I think scientists make a distinction between inspiration, as everyone does, and execution. And I imagine Greg could probably comment on it. That would be true in music. So when you're... Who knows what artistic, social, extra-scientific factors influence scientific ideas? But when it comes to producing them, producing a body of work, writing a paper, you move into a different mode, which is far removed from the inspiration. And I'm guessing it must be true in music when you perform.
As you were describing that, brought to mind the great musicologists throughout history who have categorized different periods of music. So we know Baroque, we know Classical, we know Romantic as the broad strokes. But within that, then we have these incremental developments within each of those periods, very similar to the visual arts, quite frankly. And I find that interesting that Darwin was all about categorizing the natural world, but music is also part of the natural world in a certain way. It's not a hard thing in the sense of a cup. It's more of a cerebral understanding of this relationship. And as you were asked the question about scientists separating themselves, perhaps this day and age, from the artistic side, I was born and grew up in Los Alamos. My father was the band director and orchestra director up there, and half the scientists who worked in the lab played in the community orchestra. And I thought that was very interesting because over the last four or five decades, that has changed. And we've gotten much more compartmentalized in our endeavors. Einstein played violin, for example.
Right.
And was apparently quite accomplished at that.
In this, I mean, in the case of Darwin, Darwin, of course, didn't play any instrument himself, but Emma, his wife, was an extremely gifted pianist. She had taken lessons from Chopin. In fact, Mendelssohn and Emma Darwin both shared a piano teacher at one point in their lives. So Darwin was very fond of music, was important in his life, but he himself was totally untalented.
Does music, I mean, you were talking about how I don't know if you used the word evolution from classical to romantic, that Mendelssohn is the bridge in, or one of the bridges in, but is music subject to the rules of evolution the way natural life is? I mean, you just said music is
I love that. We never thought of that. We should have gotten her on our committee about how music evolves. Absolutely evolves. Think about the modal scales of the ancient Greeks, the pentatonic tones that grew into our modern major-minor scale system, and then it was further exploded by Schoenberg and the 12-tone system, where you went beyond evolution of this tonal style, this tonal construct, to a construct that is very mathematical in its its arrangement. In effect, this 12-tone series, you can arrange it one way and then reverse it and do it backwards. It's the same series. And so it falls back on this mathematical model, as I mentioned earlier. So yes, there is an evolution in music. And why wouldn't there be?
Coincident with the event, the symphony, we have an event at the Santa Fe Institute on the multi-dimensions of Darwinism. And one of the points that we're trying to make is that it's true that the Darwinian theory was born in observations of nature, but the assumptions it makes and the models that you write down are very general. And so any system that has some mechanism of transmission, a mechanism for generating variability, is going to be subject to an evolutionary dynamic. And I think that's been one of the great secondary revolutions in evolutionary thinking, that in fact culture evolves, mathematics evolves, music evolves.
But I mean, we use the same word, but is it the same kind of evolution as in the natural world?
That's the debate. We think it's deeper than just the metaphor. The question is, you see, in biology, with the big molecular biology revolution, the discovery of genes and so forth, you could discipline the mathematics in a way that Darwin couldn't, after Mendel, of course. And in music, we don't quite know what the raw material of variation would be. Are they notes on a page? Unlikely. Are they ideas in the head of the composer? So if you were really going to be serious about constructing an evolutionary theory of music, you'd have to find some kind of analog of the heritable material.
I was just pondering the idea of how folks who have suffered a stroke often can't speak, but they can sing. And that part of the brain, which is a higher function of the brain, allows us to go beyond what is already extant. But David's correct in the sense that music is a result of an evolutionary, biological evolutionary process. While we have singing whales, and we have tones and singing in other primates, for example, we don't understand them in the same way as music, as a Beethoven symphony, or the Beatles, or the Rolling Stones, if
right.
you will. So it's a very interesting area for exploration, and this is why it so inspired us to go into this event, this Voyages of Discovery concert, this coming Saturday.
I mean, what I would like to emphasize, though, is that we these are interesting points, but they're not the central points for us. I mean, as I said before, the critical point about these people are the world they came from, the network of individuals with whom they interacted, often common individuals, this belief in a life dedicated to solving difficult problems, acute observation of the world. Those are the unifying themes, more than a reductive attempt to make music or culture material for greedy scientists intent on formulating new theories.
Well, the Voyage of Discovery, I mean, that's another very interesting point. Just as there are, as you just said, Gregory Heltman, fewer scientists perhaps playing music, there's also fewer Americans going abroad. to study. There seems to be less of a risk-taking, less of a sense of discovery, and more of a sense of maybe careerism and stuff like that, and I don't know how that affects science or music.
I think it's also affected by that idea that we can get anything we want immediately. Convenience trumps quality, convenience trumps high fidelity, convenience trumps that idea of I'm going to go out there and discover this for myself. Somebody else may have discovered how beautiful Adelaide Mountain is at sunrise, but I can go on Google at 10 o'clock in the morning with my cup of coffee and do Google Earth and watch it there. Is it convenient? I'm still in my pajamas at home. And I think we've lost something in our society because of that, that drive to go forward personally, individually, physically.
The Voyages of Discovery, Darwin and Mendelssohn, is this Saturday night, November 14th at 8 o'clock at the Lensic, and Kirk Ellis and Jonathan Richards are going to be there in period costume playing Darwin and Mendelssohn.
That's correct. It's going to be very exciting, interspersed with the music which we'll be performing, and we're going to include the Hebrides Overture, which I mentioned earlier, the Scottish Symphony. We're going to be doing a piece of music that he wrote originally for piano entitled Song Without Words. It's a beautiful early 19th century song, sort of a Schubert song, if you will, and Stephen Smith, our conductor, is arranging this for the wind of the symphony. And interspersed within this music will be commentary by David and Stephen, and then letters read both by Kirk, who will be portraying Mendelssohn, and Jonathan, who will be portraying Darwin. And the Santa Fe Opera has been great in finding costumes for them. So they'll be in period dress just to evoke a sense of timeliness or evoke a time period as they read these incredible missives that they wrote, as David said, these very small excerpts from the thousands of letters.
Yeah, and we struggled for a while as to how best to organize the evening. And we thought we'd do it chronologically, but it doesn't really work because they were born the same year, but Mendelssohn died in 1847 and Darwin in 1882. And when Mendelssohn was writing operas, Darwin was playing with beetles in his shorts in his garden. So we decided to do it thematically, and so we have a section on sort of the history, the ideas that informed their work. We have a section on exploration, the period that they traveled. We have a section on mourning. Both of them lost family members. I mean, Mendelssohn lost his mother and his sister, and Darwin his children. Annie in particular upset him. And so we're trying to arrange, have a sort of resonance or echo between the facts of their lives, the biographical details, the correspondences that they wrote, and the music that Mendelssohn composed.
Unfortunately, it's time to go. Much more to talk about. I want to thank you both for being here. Gregory Heltman, founder and general director of the Santa Fe Symphony, David Krakauer of the Santa Fe Institute.